Whether you're on the go or at the ballpark, T-Mobile is built to keep you connected wherever the game takes you. With America's best network, you know your phone is going to work, even in a crowded stadium, for instance. If you lose track of your friends, after a long seventh-inning stretch, one quick message and a shared location later, you'll find each other without missing the next pitch. And you can upload the video of the game-winning hit and share it before you even leave your seat. And on the days you can't make it to the ballpark, streaming the game on the go feels just as electric. No buffering, no interruptions, just every moment as it happens. Find out how baseball hits different with T-Mobile at T-Mobile.com/MLB. Fastest based on analysis by Ookla of speed test intelligence data of national speed score results for the second half of 2025. Best based on analysis by Ookla of the speed test intelligence data for the second half of 2025.
Shalom. Welcome to the podcast, Ask the Rabbi. I'm Rabbi Leonid Feldman. I'm the host of this podcast, and I want to thank you for listening. This is going to be episode 90. Wow. And the title I gave to this episode is A Rabbi in the Land of Multiple Gods and Spirits. But before I begin episode 90, I want to say a few words about very special sponsors of this episode. These are four extremely important people in my life who decided to do this in honor of my birthday. And I'm very touched by this sweet gesture. And the four of them are my only sister, Felina Schwartz, and my brother-in-law, Vladimir, and my only cousin, Alla Feldman, and her husband, David. My sister Felina and I grew up without a mother, so obviously we're very close. In addition, the older I get, the more similarities between us I discover. Sometimes it's like scary. And even though we now live thousands of miles away from each other, we're very involved in each other's lives. Felina listens to all of my episodes several times, and she wants to understand everything, every detail, every word. And then she discusses them with her girlfriends. She actually remembers what I said in some previous episode better than me. My sister is very precious to me. I love Felina very much, my big sister. And I pray to God to grant her a little respite from the numerous health issues she has suffered all her life. My brother-in-law Vladimir, according to anyone who knows this couple, has been truly an exceptional husband to Felina for 55 years. Of course, he has many other wonderful qualities, and I literally don't know anyone who dislikes Vladimir Schwartz. I love him as a brother. My cousin Alla and I basically grew up together, because her parents took care of us when our mom died very young. So we're not cousins in the way that word is used in America. We're brother and sister. And again, extremely close. Alla has an uncommonly optimistic attitude to life and a lot of charisma. She and David are exceptionally devoted and doting grandparents to their five grandchildren. At some point, they completely changed their lifestyle and moved to the other side of Los Angeles in order to be closer to the grandchildren. We all consider Alla as the head of our family. She loves to see the entire family together. And that includes not only the closest members, but everybody else. And whenever I arrive in Los Angeles, Alla gathers everybody and organizes a festive event. May we all continue to have many, many festive events for many years. My dear, dear family, thank you very much for everything you mean in my life. And now we can begin episode 90. This episode is very atypical because it does not deal with the Torah, the Talmud, Israel, Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinians, and so on. Allow me, please, to explain. I have recently visited one of the most fascinating countries on the planet, and I decided to share with you some of my thoughts about it. because I fell in love with that country. One of the reasons for my decision is the fact that I'm certain that most of my listeners had not been to this country, and most probably know very little or nothing about it. The name of the country is Bhutan. It's spelled with H, B-H-U-T-A-N. It is located between China and India, very close to Nepal and Bangladesh. Many years ago, I visited a wealthy member of my congregation who was very sick. This woman told me that she had been to over 80 countries, but her favorite one was Bhutan, and that is why she visited it every year for several weeks. She shared with me some unusual facts about this tiny kingdom in the Himalayas and showed me several albums of photographs. I was captivated by those stories, and I was stunned by the beauty of the pictures. This is when I decided that one day I would visit Bhutan. It has taken me many years, but I finally did it. And in order to accomplish this, I was forced to overcome some serious obstacles because several wars were going on here in Israel at the same time, simultaneously. Eventually, I managed to get out of the country by crossing the border with Jordan. And after spending a night in Amman, I flew to India on the Royal Jordanian Airline. Of course, I did not wear a kippah, and I used my American passport. Still, it was not an enjoyable journey. Suffice it to say, I was very glad not to be in a Muslim country when we landed in India. And now let's get to the main topic. I spent 6 days in India and 6 days in Bhutan. It was an organized trip, and this is the only way I was willing to go to India. However, because of the war with Iran and disruptions in air traffic, several people from my group canceled their trip. As a result, I was given a private tour with a driver and a guide in both India and Bhutan. Over the years, I heard from many people that India was one of the most fascinating countries in the world, and many people just loved their experiences there. Many young Israelis, after their army service, actually spent several months living in India. While I was extremely curious about that culture, I was always reluctant to visit it because I knew a lot about the extreme poverty, the filth, the stench, the noise, the ubiquitous begging, the caste system, and so on. In addition, many years ago, I learned about the city called Varanasi, and this was another reason I did not want to go there. Varanasi is one of the holiest Hindu sites in India, famous for its open-air, large-scale public cremations. Huge fires are in the middle of the city, and it goes on 24 hours a day. And those cremations have been practiced there for centuries. That is why Varanasi is also called the City of Death. Thousands of people travel there annually specifically to die and be cremated. The one detail about India I was not prepared for, and which truly shocked me, was the fact that, are you ready for this? Indians do not believe in toilet paper. However, I will not get into the details here, and you can obviously read about it if you're interested. Nevertheless, despite all these reasons, I was always interested in visiting India, and I'm glad I finally did it. My itinerary covered only the northern and eastern parts and small parts of the country, and I realized that what I experienced was a very tiny part of that huge country with a population of 1.5 billion people. More people live in India today than in China. India is a gigantic country with 22 official languages, over 90 16,000 dialects and over 2.5 distinct ethnic groups. In addition, there are thousands of different tribes and subgroups. It is literally impossible to understand and appreciate such diversity during a short trip like mine. One needs to spend much, much more time there to really get to know that mind-blowing nation and culture. And yet, I was able to visit some famous and important sites, and I learned a lot about the people, their religion, and their culture. First of all, obviously, I visited one of the seven wonders of the world, the Taj Mahal in Agra. As most people know, it is a breathtaking mausoleum of white marble built in the 17th century by Emperor Shah Jahan in memory of his beloved wife, who gave him 15 children and who died giving birth to number 16. I also stood at the tomb of Mahatma Gandhi, who is venerated as the father of the Indian nation. Historians today believe that Gandhi's legacy is definitely not all positive, and he is sharply criticized by the majority of Jewish historians for his attitude towards Zionism. For example, in 1938, he wrote in an article, and I quote now, "Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French." This is 1938. The Holocaust is about to begin. Jews are desperate to get out of Europe. And this is what he says. Gandhi considered Zionism to be a clear case of colonialism and a form of imperialism. When Hitler began his brutal policies against the Jews, Gandhi advised Jewish leaders to employ nonviolent resistance against both Nazi persecution in Europe and Arab hostility in Palestine. We know what would have happened to the Jewish people had the leaders listened to his advice. After New Delhi and Agra, I flew to the state of West Bengal, which is actually more Nepalese than Indian. Since most people came there originally from Nepal, the main languages used there are Bengali and Nepalese, which are very different from Hindi. It was very interesting to watch two Indians trying to communicate with each other in broken English. One of the main attractions for tourists in India are the numerous Hindu and Buddhist temples and monasteries. I had some fascinating conversations with several monks about their lives and beliefs. Many of them begin their monastic lifestyle when they're teenagers, and most never leave because that is considered a betrayal against the faith. One monk spent almost an hour with me describing their lives. He had lived in that particular monastery for 29 years and had rarely seen his family in all that time. The monks spend most of their time in prayer and meditation, and they seem to be content. One of my most moving experiences was the visit to a Tibetan refugee center. Approximately 100,000 Tibetan refugees reside in India today. They fled Tibet alongside the Dalai Lama in 1959, seeking asylum in India. At that time, the government of India provided actually land to settle these refugees, allowing them to preserve their distinct cultural and religious identity. And today, until today, the Tibetans are extremely grateful to India for welcoming them when they were homeless and helpless. The government provides special schools for Tibetans and reserves university seats for them. On the other hand, they're not Indian citizens, and acquiring citizenship is very complicated. All refugees in the center I visited work even when they are in their 80s And these people do not depend on the government at all. I saw several workshops and tiny factories, and I spoke to a few of the artisans who create beautiful things there and sell them to support the center. I met a young woman there in her late 20s who grew up in this center. Literally, this is the only home she knows. She is now a second generation refugee, and she proudly told me that her 5-year-old boy is third generation. She married another refugee in this center, and he is now a professor of Tibetan history at a university near New Delhi. Because of the enormous distance, her husband comes to visit his family during summer and winter vacations. I asked this woman if this was very hard and if she missed him. She smiled and said that, no, thanks to FaceTime on the phone, it's not too bad at all, since they see each other almost every day. A conversation like this definitely puts everything in perspective. Another memorable conversation I had was with four young women, recent graduates of a university several hours away from where we met. They were visiting one of the oldest Tibetan Buddhist monasteries. All of them spoke good English, which I was actually able to understand. As many of you probably know, Indian accent in English may be the worst in the world. One of the girls was Sikh. Two of them were Buddhists, and one was Hindu. I was very curious about life for young, educated people, especially their customs and traditions. They told me, for example, that the idea of dating does not really exist in India. If it is not an arranged marriage, a young couple may go on 2 or 3 dates, and then they discuss marriage. When I asked them what happens if a couple date for 6 months or longer, they burst into laughter. One of them said, "My parents would disown me in that case." All of these women belong to the lowest caste of the four famous ones. So I was curious, what happens if you like a boy, but he belongs to a higher caste? Apparently, it actually happened to one of them at the university, when she was interested in a handsome boy in a commerce class, and he was interested in her too. Unfortunately, he was from a higher caste. So when he asked his parents for permission to invite her to dinner, they absolutely forbade this. After that, he began to avoid this girl and very soon got married. I was curious to find out how Indian people determine the caste of another person. Apparently, it is done easily, thanks to the last names. I must clarify that the caste system is not important in all the states in India. And in fact, it's been outlawed for many years. For example, I visited an unusual state called Sikkim, which is the youngest state, and it is predominantly Buddhist. Because it is on the border of China, security there is very tight. To enter the state, foreigners need a special visa in addition to the Indian visa, copies of the passport, several photos, and on and on. So when a border official saw in my passport that I was born in Moldova, a comical and amusing thing took place. They began to look for a map of the world to find my country, which took a long time. Finally, my guide found the map in his cell phone, but the name of the capital of Moldova is now Chisinau, whereas I wrote in the form that I was born in Kishinev. As a result, they called an officer in military uniform who was apparently the supervisor of that office. He became alarmed when he saw 2 Chinese stamps, visas, in my American passport, and kept reading slowly and carefully all the other stamps In addition, I had to answer numerous irrelevant questions, and all these details were written by hand using a pencil in an old notebook. Looked like it was 50 years old. Finally, I received a stamp of the state of Sikkim. I had to go to another office across the street where they took my photo and stamped my passport again. Once again, there was an old notebook where all this information was recorded by hand using a pencil. I must say that I actually enjoyed the state of Sikkim much more than New Delhi and West Bengal. Vast tea plantations there span across the lush mountains and hills. The famous Darjeeling tea is known as the Champagne of Teas, and it is named after the city with the same name. There are hundreds of different kinds of tea in that area, and many tourists enjoy visiting various estates for tea tastings. Tea is much more popular than coffee in India. So I really struggled until I found a coffee shop with real espresso and cappuccino only when I arrived in Bhutan. One of the prettiest places in Sikkim was the Somo Lake, which is considered sacred. It is forbidden to swim there or ride a boat in it. There are many legends connected with this lake, but one in particular is very famous. Apparently, a few years ago, a major landslide happened there. Thousands of people lost their lives on that day, and witnesses claim that the lake turned completely black. The lake is located at a height of almost 4,000 meters, and it is surrounded by snow and ice. Many people they preferred to climb to the lake on the back of a yak because of the altitude. It's very hard to actually breathe on that added altitude. I considered doing the same. However, I chose to walk up because the smell of that animal was, how should I put it, overwhelming. Of course, I did several things simply for fun during my time in India. I took several rides on the famous tuk-tuks. I also rode on another kind of a taxi, which is a bicycle pulled by a man. And some of them are in this, at least they look like they're in the 60s. I guess they're in good shape because of this. I also went horseback riding and took a boat ride on a pretty lake in the mountains, as well as a cable car ride overlooking a big city. I visited the oldest spice market in Asia, and I even received a VIP tour of an elegant casino where they offered me drinks right away. I learned a lot in a special museum about all the people who made it to the top of Mount Everest. Beautiful museum, huge. But I also learned about many people who died trying to accomplish this. There are many more interesting stories I can share with you about India, but remember the main goal of this episode is to tell you about the truly unique kingdom of Bhutan. So let's begin. The moment I crossed the border from India to Bhutan, I felt as if I was on a different planet. The contrast between these two countries cannot be more glaring. In India, the traffic is unmanageable, with cars, motorcycles, trucks, mopeds, bicycles, tuk-tuks, driving in all kinds of directions. There are no rules, no speed limits. Dogs are running in the roads. Beggars walk between the cars. Cows stand in the middle of the chaos, sometimes walking slowly on highways. I took a lot of pictures of that. The honking is literally nonstop. It continues uninterrupted, even during the night. They basically told me, my drivers explained to me that this is part of culture. It's just a custom. They drive, they beep for no reason. They honk. I guess it's ego. Who knows? Remember, the population of New Delhi is over 30 million people. For comparison, the entire country of Israel has 10 million inhabitants. And what about the Kingdom of Bhutan? Their total population is 740,000. It is simply not fair to compare India and Bhutan. But let me tell you some interesting facts about Bhutan. Honking, for example, in Bhutan is against the law. So as a result, it feels calm, even serene. As many of you probably know, this country is known as the land of happiness. The official reason for this is the fact that the king of Bhutan in the 1970s came up with a fascinating idea. National progress and success in his kingdom are measured not by gross domestic product, GDP, but by gross national happiness, GNH. This holistic framework prioritizes collective well-being over pure economic output. Instead of asking how much did we produce, the government asks how well are people doing. The GNX index is focused on the population's health, psychological well-being, education, cultural diversity, community vitality, protection of nature, and finally, living standards. You may be curious to know how happy the citizens of Bhutan are. Well, according to Bhutan's own national surveys, a majority of the population, about 48%, is classified as extensively happy. I just quoted. While about 9.5% are considered deeply happy. On the other hand, the United Nations World Happiness Report ranks Bhutan around 95th in the world. Now, I must make it clear that this is a developing country, which is poor and without natural resources. And yet, this fact is not obvious at all to a visitor, because people in the street seem to be content, they smile a lot, and they even try to be helpful. By the way, despite several wars fought simultaneously, instability and national trauma, according to the 2026 World Happiness Report, Israel ranks as the 8th happiest country globally. Meanwhile, the United States is in 23rd place in 2026. Actually, just 4 years ago, before October 7th, before all the wars, Israel climbed all the way to number 4 in the world. 4 in the entire world. It's fascinating. There is a lot of research done. And I had a podcast devoted to this. Why are Israelis so happy? The king of Bhutan is universally loved by the population. I heard constantly, His Majesty said this, or His Majesty did that. The manager in my hotel told me he was willing to give his life for the king. And everybody in the country knows that the royal family lives in a simple house and the king drives his Toyota by himself. The country was totally isolated for centuries until a few decades ago. Television was introduced only in 1999. The health system is completely free. If somebody needs a special treatment abroad, the government will pay for it. My guide explained to me, His Majesty wants us to be happy. A few years ago, the king voluntarily announced that he was going to abdicate the throne. The entire population rebelled and asked him not to do this. It is one of the youngest democracies in the world. Elections for a prime minister are held every 5 years. Education in Bhutan is free for all children between the ages of 2 years old until 18. But how can Bhutan afford all of these benefits? Well, a major source of revenue for the country comes from tourism. However, the king has an interesting philosophy here too. It is called high value, low volume. In order to visit Bhutan, foreigners have to pay $100 per day, which goes directly to the national budget. In addition, a tourist must reserve in advance a guide and a driver in order to enter the country. And that is pretty cheap, obviously. This nation is one of the pioneers in the field of ecology. The whole world is learning. They're sending delegations to learn from Bhutan how they're doing this. For example, according to the constitution, at least 60% of its territory must be filled by forests. As a result, Bhutan is the only country in the world which is carbon negative. It means that it emits more oxygen into the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. In other words, this country actively cleans the atmosphere. According to the law, if one tree is cut, two other trees must be planted. Hunting is strictly forbidden, and a person is allowed to catch only 3 fish, even after getting a permit from the government. Smoking has been banned for several years, and tobacco products are unavailable anywhere. There are no traffic lights in the entire country, which means, you can understand, the drivers must be extremely polite with the people they share the roads with. So, for example, a few years ago, the government decided to install one traffic light in the main intersection in the capital. Very soon afterwards, the people complained that it was too confusing. So instead of the traffic light, now a man in a uniform stands there in a little booth and directs the traffic with beautiful, almost ballet-like movements. Pedestrians must cross the street only in designated areas. There is absolutely no crime, and begging is against the law. The streets are extremely clean, and residents take recycling and garbage disposal very seriously. I actually witnessed downtown how a garbage truck arrived in a neighborhood, and people came out of restaurants, offices, homes, carrying their trash in neatly packaged non-plastic bags. A tourist from India stood next to me, watching this scene in awe. He told me he was ashamed of how dirty his country was. Polygamy and polyandry, which means women can have more than one husband, are legal in Bhutan. However, this is highly regulated, and it is becoming rare among the younger generations. Under the law, a man is permitted to have up to 3 wives, but this requires formal consent of the first wife. Also, additional spouses do not hold the same legal standing regarding the division of assets in case of divorce. The most famous tourist attraction in Bhutan is the Tiger Nest Monastery, which was built in 1646. It's stunning. I'm sure many of you have seen the pictures. It's a unique structure descending from an extremely steep, high mountain. This is always the first photo on any postcard or on the cover of any book about Bhutan. I was told that some of the monks up there, who live up there, they have not come down to civilization in decades. By the way, I found it interesting that monks are not allowed to vote or get involved in politics, separation of state and religion. It takes numerous hours for a physically strong person to climb to the top, which is considered a major achievement. A few years ago, His Majesty the King carried his young son to the monastery all the way up, and the entire nation was watching this in awe on television. Apparently, Prince William also climbed to the top of the special place, and it was shown on BBC. At this point, as we're coming to the end of the episode, I feel that I need to address the elephant in the room, so to speak. I'm speaking about the obvious differences between the absolute monotheism of Judaism and the multiplicity of gods, goddesses, and spirits in both Hinduism and Buddhism. Both of these traditions play an extremely important role in the lives of the citizens. Numerous temples and monasteries are spread all over both countries, and each one of them has a mystical story connected to it. I have to admit that as a Jew and a rabbi, I had problems with both religions, but I had more problems with Hinduism than with Buddhism. For example, Hinduism has literally millions of deities, I guess, like Vishnu, Shiva, Devi, and many, many others. While Judaism strictly forbids any physical representation of the divine or idols, images and statues are absolutely central to worship in Hinduism. According to Hinduism, a person's current life is influenced by their karma from previous lives, which means their deeds. In Judaism, the focus is on the soul's journey in this life and in the afterlife. I must say that there are also major differences between Judaism and Buddhism, but I would like to mention first some of the shared principles and practices between these two ancient spiritual traditions. Both Judaism and Buddhism prioritize action over abstract belief. This is very different from Christianity and Islam. In Judaism, the focus on actions is expressed through mitzvot, given to us by the master of the universe. Buddhism emphasizes right speech, right action, and compassion for all beings. Kindness and relief of suffering are central to both faiths. Studying Torah and Talmud as a way to refine one's character and to get closer to God is absolutely vital to Judaism. Meditation and the study of sutras to achieve mindfulness and clarity of mind is what Buddhism is identified with all over the world. There are numerous other aspects of Buddhism that make it extremely attractive to millions of people in the West. But I want to add only one more idea, which had an important influence on my personal life. Many years ago, I went to a lecture on Buddhism given by a well-known expert who was a practicing Buddhist. He began his lecture by saying something like the following. He said, "If you forget everything I'm going to say today, try to remember one idea which is central to Buddhism and which will probably make you a happier person." And he continued, "According to Buddhism, the main reason for human suffering is our attachments and expectations." Attachments and expectations. We should take some time to think about those two words. I have never forgot that idea. Never forgotten that idea. And serving as a rabbi in a community for many years, I witnessed the truth of it again and again. People with high expectations suffer much more than those who expect much less. We have to stop here. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to thank my dear family And I want to encourage you. I suspect this episode will have some interesting reactions. So please write to me. I'm very curious what you think about what I shared with you. My email is rableonid, RABLEONID, @gmail.com. Shalom.
Whether you're on the go or at the ballpark, T-Mobile is built to keep you connected wherever the game takes you. With America's best network, you know your phone is going to work, even in a crowded stadium, for instance. If you lose track of your friends, after a long seventh-inning stretch, one quick message and a shared location later, you'll find each other without missing the next pitch. And you can upload the video of the game-winning hit and share it before you even leave your seat. And on the days you can't make it to the ballpark, streaming the game on the go feels just as electric. No buffering, no interruptions, just every moment as it happens. Find out how baseball hits different with T-Mobile at T-Mobile.com/MLB. Fastest based on analysis by Ookla of speed test intelligence data of national speed score results for the second half of 2025. Best based on analysis by Ookla of the speed test intelligence data for the second half of 2025.